everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today, I'll be interviewing Robert Rudekirk, the Rotterdam School of Management and the Department of Technology and Operations Management. And before we get started, I want to say that we have a Patreon now where you can support us, where I can invest it back to you all with better equipment, content, and to help with my passion in technology, business, and public policy. My name is Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. Well, first of all, I'd like to ask about your journey from graduating from your undergraduate to where you are today.
Thank you, Ken. Well, first of all, it's nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation. So what you see behind me is the campus of the Erasmus University. That's where I obtained my master's degree in econometrics with a logistics specialization. So I basically started my career off studying inventory problems, network optimization. I then spent a year at the University of Florida, working at the Industrial Systems Engineering Department, building a water supply management system for Cocoa Beach, fun time. And then after that, I pursued a PhD in marketing. So as some of my friends would say, I joined the dark side. And I think that basically set me up for doing what I'm doing today, which is research at the intersection of marketing operations in retail. So I study a wide range of retail challenges, mostly omnichannel retail, retail analytics, but always with a lens of combining these two functions. And so analytics, I'm also the academic director here of the Master of Business Analytics and Management at the Rotterdam School of Management. So that's the business school of Erasmus University. And so that's pretty much how I got here and what I'm doing today.
Well, that's great to hear. And thank you for the introduction. And you are a professor at among the best business schools in the world, the Rotterdam School of Management. And you've done amazing academic research on retail analytics. And one of your papers, you do an analysis of 123 analytics articles. What was your inspiration for the paper?
So analytics in retail is something you hear a lot, right? So we hear big data or business analytics across the board. And retail seems to be one of those areas that is really well suited for analytics in the sense that there's a lot of data that's available, and that data is also increasingly unlocked or shared. So we started off, you know, decades ago with just point of sales data, right? Whenever you go to the register, you hear those beeps, and that's all data that's being collected on how much a retailer is selling that day. That's really the most essential data. But you also see new types of data, right? So there's video cameras that are we started out using them for security, but now we also use them to count people, traffic counters. There is IoT sensor data. So this is wealth of data coming into retail. And at the same time, there's a lot of data-rich business models, such as online retail, omnichannel retail, that are really built around retail, around data. And so that back the question. So we've done a lot of research on this as academics over the past two decades. So how far have we come? What have we studied? And but also how far is practice, right? So we have this image of retail being very data driven and very data savvy. Is that actually the case? And also moving forward, what as academics should we be studying to help retailers moving forward? So what should we be doing in the next couple of years that is most relevant to practitioners, but also feasible in the sense that we can do this with data that's either available or becoming available soon.
I definitely agree that data is becoming a lot more available at places at the University of California, Berkeley. There's being expanded a data science institute where a lot of students get master's in data science degrees or undergrad degrees. So there's a lot of data to be analyzed, and a lot of my friends and colleagues are trying to analyze that data. And I know that you isolated 9 decision areas using automated text analysis. And from those automated text analysis through topic modeling, what did you discover, Professor?
Yeah, so topic modeling is kind of a way to process large amounts of text and to kind of see whether there's some underlying structure. And so topic modeling, which is kind of a basic form of text analysis, has been around now for a little more than a decade. Assumes that every article or every document has, you know, a range of topics in it. And so every topic occurs with a certain probability in the document. And topics themselves are associated with keywords, right? With certain words. So let's say I use a lot of inventory, I use stockouts. Well, that potentially is related to inventory management. Demand probing, demand sensing, forecasting, maybe actually demand planning. So but it does that in an automatic way. So it's kind of it's an unsupervised machine learning technique. And so we actually used this to validate manual coding, because 123 articles is not massive, right? So we could still do this manually. And we actually found a huge correspondence between what the automated coding found and what we as manual coders found. And these were 9 decision areas that are represented in the, let's say, last 2 decades of academic research on retail analytics. And these are, some are very established. So inventory management, demand planning, assortment optimization, that's something we've been studying for 2 decades now. But what's interesting is that there's also a couple of emerging decision areas in there. And so one is, for instance, returns handling. And you could easily see how that came to fruition because of online retail, right? We started buying more online. So returns handling, returns forecasting, trying to avoid returns, has become an important topic for academics to study. The other thing is that we have new data sources. So one of those data sources is video. And so using video analytics, we can actually study a lot more about customer-employee interactions, so customer service operations. And so you see these kind of new decision areas coming up, either because there's new business models that make them relevant, or because there's new data sources that came about that allowed us to answer new or go after new questions.
And it seems like you answered a lot of questions from these conversations. And what were you able to shed light on from your research, Professor?
Yeah, so the conversations that you refer to is the second part of our article, right? So first we study the academic literature, we need to see kind of inward looking, what have we studied, and the conversations, they were really with practitioners, right? So kind of, so where's practice at? And so what we did is we interviewed about 24 organizations across the retail value chain. So these are Amazon, Walmart, Wayfair, Target, but also some consulting firms. We had Alibaba, we had the head of analytics of the Hema Fresh stores in China. And so we had a wide range of geographies, South America, North America, Europe, and Asia. And we basically asked them a bunch of questions. And the first one was really like, how advanced are your analytics? And surprisingly, perhaps, the answer was that it's pretty basic. It's actually quite backward looking. So it's often relying heavily on dashboards, on reports. And these tell you that something happened. They often don't even tell you why something happened, right? For that, you need some kind of models like, okay, so I sold less in the past quarter, but there's no explanation why that is.
Yeah.
For that, you need to dig a bit deeper, right? Were there a lot of stockouts? Did your competitor do some promotions? Was the parking lot broken up, right? Was the city working on your parking lot? So there could be various reasons, and for that you need to dig a bit deeper. So that was really the first surprise, if you will. There were obviously also companies in our set of interviewees that are really ahead of the curve, so the Amazons, the Walmarts. And so that also allowed us to kind of compare these companies that are really ahead to the ones that are kind of lagging behind and distill what blocks people from making analytics work and what makes companies thrive in terms of analytics, you know, the ones that are on the frontier.
Sure. And with your research, what sort of direction do you hope to provide for readers of your research?
Yeah, so first of all, I think it's a better understanding to academics of the state of practice. I think if we really want to do a good job in studying practice, we need to know what the state is. And I think we've uncovered those kind of 6 factors that you know, enable retailers to either excel in analytics or lag behind. And those are the company culture. So is there really a data savvy culture? Is there a C-suite champion? It's how you organize for analytics. And our research seems to suggest that some kind of hub and spoke network where there's a central unit that oversees analytics, but also a decentral embedding of the analytics in the business function is something that's the best compromise between centralized and decentralizing this. It's people. Right. So you just talked about some of the people you know around campus studying analytics, and there is a huge need for people like that. So everyone's screaming for analytics talent. These are very hard to find at the moment. So that's also why at RSM we have a master program now, which currently has 120 students, but I think I could easily have 300-400 a year, but we actually cap it because it's very intense. There's a lot of interaction with faculty. It's processes, right? So clear ownership of who owns analytics. It's systems. Often retailers deal with legacy systems, right? So they started off in physical retail, Then they somehow started an online business, but they made it completely separate from the physical retail. Sometimes you need to, because you need different type of people to understand online retail. But now in omnichannel, you need to make these things work together, right? So it's click and collect. It's about me as a customer knowing that I can pick something up in the store. And that means that you as a retailer need to know it's either an inventory or how quickly you're able to ship it from the DC to the store. So that's, and then the sixth one is data, right? So proper master data management. So I think moving forward, it's this understanding on the side of academics of, you know, there's a reason why maybe practice is not as advanced, and we could study how to remove those barriers and also study what enablers retailers could use. It's to practitioners, obviously, there's a clear insight in, especially from the companies that are on the forefront. So what are they doing? So why is it that Amazon makes this work? And one is, for instance, a lot of internal knowledge sharing. So internal wikis, conferences, but it's also an agile mindset. So with analytics, it's very much like do experimentation, start, fill, you know, hit a wall, start over again, and every day try to make your decision making better. So it can be very daunting when you're not very savvy with data to see that point on the horizon, right? That, you know, all these companies that are super data driven, but just start by identifying what decision you could be slightly better at, but a bit more thinking and a bit more use of data. So that's on the practitioner side. And then combined, we also hope that our article provides directions for academics on what to work on the next couple of years.
I want to zoom back into early on in your paper, where you talk about five different types of analytics with different levels of sophistication, such as descriptive, diagnostic, predictive, prescriptive, and autonomous analytics. What exactly are those diagnostics, and what are the gaps in the literature pertaining to the different decision areas?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? Because we always hear analytics and we hear big data, and it seems to be everything's like put on one big pile. Yeah. So analytics come in different types of, I would say, complexities. But they also come in with, they're associated with different levels of competitive advantage. And so if you start with the simplest form of analytics, we refer to those as descriptive analytics. So this is really just describing what happened. It's backward looking and it's hindsight, right? There's no explanation for it. So this is a dashboard, a report, something that currently retail is mostly at. You go a little bit further, you go a bit more advanced, you go to something that's called diagnostic analytics, which is actually that you try to go from hindsight to insight, which means that you try to come up with an explanation, why did this happen? And that could be using some modeling, right? So maybe I have my sales, I correlate that with my marketing mix instruments, those of my competitors, and I try to come up with some kind of explanation as to, you know, whether my increased sales is due to a price decrease or because the competitor increased his or her prices. But it's still backward looking. And what we really want to do in analytics is look towards the future. So the first type there is what we call predictive analytics, or what in practice people call forecasting. You know, you want to kind of get an idea of what will happen. And you could see how that's very important in retail. There's long lead times. We need to order things. Some retailers are currently talking about the fact that they're dealing with three Christmases. The Christmas of last year, where they're still waiting for stuff to arrive from the East. This year's Christmas, and they're ramping up because they need to determine what they're going to order for next Christmas. So this is you need forecasting, right, to do that. But that's still, you're still kind of like in the co-pilot seat, right? And what you want to do is you want to be in the driver's seat. And being in the driver's seat is, what should I do to make something happen? And that's prescriptive analytics. Prescriptive analytics is, I let the analytics tell me what I should do, what action I should take, what assortment I put in the store, how many employees I put in the store, the staffing decisions, my routing, whatever it is that I can optimize, what should I do? And what should I do to make something happen? And that could be maximize revenues, maximize profitability, increase customer satisfaction, or typically some kind of weighted objective function where you're trying to both look at your bottom line and please your customers. So these are the four essential types, and you'll see them in other papers as well. And then there's a kind of a fifth type, and this is kind of maybe a bit futuristic, but it's something that's called autonomous analytics. And these are really analytics that are obviously trained still by humans, although the future will probably be that algorithms will write algorithms, or you know, there will be automated writing of analytics programs probably. But The idea is that analytics people write algorithms and they're basically released or let loose. They train themselves, they learn, they update. And by getting more data, they become smarter. And that's, so, for instance, a lot of your online algorithms where with every customer that comes in, I learn. And that's also the interesting debate now between when you hear between AI, between China, let's say, and the US. China is taking a big leap at this moment because just because of the sheer amount of data that some of these retailers are getting in. So JD or Alibaba, a few years back, I think Alibaba had 11 million unique websites during Singles Day. That's just the amount of volume you're talking about. So you can imagine that with hundreds of millions of customers, you just learn faster. And that's where these autonomous algorithms come in.
That, I want to go off off of what Ruja was talking about the research paper, and that's the competition between America and China. You know, I live in the Silicon Valley where all big tech is here, all the big tech companies, all the data analytics, a lot of you know, the talent is here for tech and analytics. So if you were to speak right now to the congressman or congresswoman of this area or governor or even the president of the United States and how America can start competing and having a competitive advantage against China, what would you say? You know, we should start investing into compete with what China is doing with their AI.
Yeah. So I think if you look at AI, there are very different models. If you compare North America, U.S. mostly to China and then to Europe. So I think if you look at the U.S., we often talk about the big tech companies in Silicon Valley, and I would say that is a model that has always been very asset heavy in a way. So in retail, for instance, you look at Amazon, that's owning a lot of planes, is owning a lot of warehouses, actually currently too many warehouses, right? So they rent some off.
Yeah.
Walmart owns a lot of other things. And if you look at China, the system there is much more ecosystem based, right? So the Chinese are very good in partnering. It's not that a JD or Alibaba own everything, right? They work with partners, with delivery partners, with logistics third party providers, but it's about getting a lot of customers via different touch points into that network. And so that means that they amass a lot of data. So the starting point in the industry is quite different. I think North America is very asset heavy, and in China, it's much more ecosystem and super apps. If you look at AI strategy-wise, in China, you see a clear state agenda, a thinking behind it, right? An investment plan. There's a lot of investment being made in it, and the state takes active control in this. And you could say for good or for worse, but at least there's a vision on this is why we want to invest in AI, and there's a lot of investment going on in there. And then obviously there's a couple of big companies that take the lead in that, and then sometimes Beijing tightens the leash a little bit, but that seems to be going on. In the US, my perception is that it's left mostly to the market. There's a lot of the free market thinking, which in many ways is good, but then sometimes obviously you see that there's issues with privacy. We all remember the Cambridge Analytica scandal. I think for the US, but also for Europe, to compete with China, I think private-public partnerships are going to be very, very important. And it needs to be also a state-run or a government a policy on how to invest in AI in a way where society benefits, right? Where not the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, because one can easily see that, right? If AI becomes a horse race where the biggest companies get bigger and accrue a lot of market power, that's not going to lead to societal welfare. So I think the US and also me as a European, I think also Europe could potentially have an interesting role where we would be in the middle between that on that spectrum from state versus free market. I think if you now look at the first initiatives taken by the European Union, and so for instance here in the Netherlands, we're really trying to come up with this kind of fair AI that should benefit society, where privacy is not an afterthought, but it's embedded from the get-go by design, right? We have GDPR, but you also have the California Privacy Act, obviously. And China also has privacy regulations. People think that, that in many cases, China is the wild west, but that's not the case. And we should also not forget that it's not easy for Chinese retailers to just take their business and go to North America or Europe either, right? So we haven't seen JD or Alibaba launch stores here. Well, JD did in the Netherlands, and they're actually closing them right now because it isn't a big success. So I think sticking to our own market and our own market knowledge and having our own source of AI, but then a coordinated one, a long-term vision that bundles investments, public-private partnerships, and tries to do it in a way that benefits everyone in society. I think that should be the model of the West.
Well, thank you for that response, Professor. I'll be sure to forward this to some of our legislators. But I do want to take note that, you know, for a public-private partnership to work, it might be interesting in principle in the European Union because of the geography and the different homogeneity in Europe. But whereas in America, it's more, you can call it a lot more diversity, a lot more different geographic areas, and there's just so many different types of places. Like, how would we implement like a single federal policy that would, you know, regulate AI or not regulate AI to, you know, encompass the entirety of the United States of America?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think Europeans often look at the US and say the market is much more homogenous in the US, right? First of all, you have a single language, you have a single currency. If we look at the greater Europe, obviously the Eurozone is quite large, but you know, with the UK, with Brexit, we still don't have a completely unified market. And also see AI, there's in parallel some countries are developing an AI policy, and then there's the European Union, and there's a continuous battle between how much Brussels decide versus how much the capitals decide, right? So there's, in that sense, it may be harder in Europe. I actually think in many ways it's easy. I just think that that I, like I said before, I think in North America it's just left too long, too much to the market, right? But I think now we see a counter a movement there. You know, some senators advocating the breaking up of big tech or more regulation. So I think you see a counter movement there. But I don't think it's harder. It should be harder in the US. But yes, you have a federal system, but then we also have the Europe is also a federal system in many ways, right?
I'm also curious. What is the situation with retailers out in the European Union, such as Amazon? Yeah. Like you mentioned, warehouses. Like, could you elaborate a little bit more on that? Yeah.
Well, so if you look at some of the European countries, it differs how successful Amazon has been. So take the Netherlands. So Amazon for a long time did not have a Dutch website. At some point, it translated the website in Dutch, which was very clunky. It didn't have a DC. The DC was still in Germany. We have a couple of very strong local players here in the Netherlands. For instance, Amazon is not the number one in consumer electronics. We also have a very strong platform that is owned by Aldo Hess, bol.com. So we have many strong retailers in Europe, Carrefour, Net. But obviously, if Amazon or other companies come and bring in the big guns, the limitation is a bit the skill, right? So Amazon, of course, has the huge skill. And for a European retailer to grow, it's quite hard to grow across borders. So even a big company such as Aldo has, which makes an annual revenue of 76 billion euro, right? That's more than Adidas and Nike combined, just for to provide an understanding of that number. They have different banners in every country. So they will have a Dutch banner supermarket chain. They will have one in Belgium, which is a different banner, although they recently also have the Dutch banner in Belgium. But so, and those banners are really run as separate entities, right? And now these retailers are also thinking, how can we build up the skill and analytics, have more sharing between those banners? But yeah, the European model is very, I think many European retailers are quite good in logistics, in efficiency, have a good understanding of the local markets. And that's not something that's easy to just copy or compete with. There's also a loyalty of European customers with their local banners. And I think it's also different. The European retailers are somewhat more hesitant when it comes to, for instance, privacy, right, with GDPR. So I think if there's, in China, you can use facial recognition to kind of see who the customer is. And then the salesperson could say, hey, it's good to see you back. You know, you've purchased this, this will grow. That would not be allowed on the GDPR. It can in Dubai. So you see that there's, you know, less, and retailers are very hesitant to dip in that. So even video analytics, they would use it to look at inventory, like stockouts, but they wouldn't really use it to learn more about their customers. They'd be very hesitant to do that because GDPR would also forbid it.
I also want to ask, you mentioned in your paper some enablers to potential barriers according to some interviews, you know, for example, let's say you have a lack of analytics talent. How would you solve that? And, you know, whether it's talking to university chancellors or whether it's talking to the government, like how would you advise governments or universities?
Yeah. So currently, there's not a lot of analytics programs are popping up left and right. They're quite quite young. The market has been asking for those for quite a while. I think, first of all, if I have to talk to legislation, I would say give universities more freedom to design new programs. Office in the European system or the Dutch system, it's very tedious to design a new master program. You have to go through a whole accreditation process that can easily take 3 years, which is, to me, that's like that's an eternity. So typically find ways, right? In universities are a bit like ocean steamers, right? They take a very long time to change course. And then we want to, we're a business school where the Dutch are known to be very entrepreneurial. So then it's quite annoying that I have to go and jump to all sorts of hoops to say, I would have to write a very expensive report showing that there is a market for analytics people. I'm like, well, if our prime minister would just take a couple of minutes to call the top 10 CEOs in the Netherlands, like probably by the end of the first 2 minutes, he would know the answer to that question, right? It would save me a lot of money and us a lot of time. So I think that, yeah, there needs to be more understanding of moving quicker. I think in training analytics talent, I think what is really important is that I see a lot of programs where it's a lot about the techniques. It's a lot about just the machine learning and the AI and I think proper analytics is more than just some fancy methods. It starts with a profound understanding of the problems that you're trying to solve using the analytics. So that means you need in business, that means you need a business understanding. So I always explain this as kind of using the Chinese diabolo, right? So diabolo, which starts wide, narrows down, and then widens again. So you start with a very unstructured, typically vague, ill-defined business problem where, as an analytics person, you talk to the business owner who either explains you a symptom and not the problem, or is not clear what the problem is him or herself. And you need to, together with that business owner, make sense of the problem so that you're actually solving the right problem. Because otherwise you provide the right answer to the wrong problem. So it starts with that. Then scoping the problem to a clear research problem. And then the second thing is analytics should be decision driven. So it should start with, okay, this is the decision I'm trying to improve. So I always tell my students, ask yourself the who can do what better now. So every time you do an analytics project, who? So what person or organization is going to do what decision better now after your research? So it's like, oh, it's just an interesting insight. No, you want actionable insights. So that actually shapes your need for the solution, the answer. Then the machinery comes in. But that's not where it stops, right? We're not going to feed like complex figures and tables to decision makers. They need to get this in a digestible manner. It needs to be persuasive, so good visualization. So there's much more than just the machinery, the machine learning and AI. So I think that understanding needs to be there in training. When you go to companies, I think what they need to realize is that attracting analytics talented analytics people want to work with other talented analytics people. So if you ask people where they want to work on instinct problems with colleagues that are, you know, that they can learn a few things from in an atmosphere where they feel autonomy. Where it's not like, okay, people are dictating the analytics. It's the new creatives in many ways. So give them the room to do this. And obviously that could come with that occasion they have to pitch, like, you know, I want to work on this. I think it's relevant. But that's so give them that freedom to work on uninteresting things. And then people come and they'll stay.
Yeah, well, thank you for that management advice and your analysis of you know, the state of what we should do to, in terms of companies, universities, and maybe I'll forward this to the president. I don't know if he'll listen to my podcast just yet. The next question I have for you is, I know you mentioned some future research earlier on in the podcast, and that's predictive analytics or AI. Like, what sort of direction do you hope that this sort of research should start heading in, let's say, the next 5, 10, 15, and then 50 years down the line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think for so in the paper, we basically identify four ways in which we could, four avenues for future research. The first one is studying new decisions, so things we have not studied yet. And those could be, you know, new problems that arise. You could think of drones, right? At some point, there will be drone delivery. We need to make heuristics that determine how we do drone delivery, because, you know, those things didn't exist, that we didn't have the heuristics. And you already have some academic research, including by some of my colleagues, on that. Truck platooning, you know. So there'll be new decisions that we want to study. For the young decision areas, such as customer service and employee management, that are really just up and coming because of new data, we should be applying more advanced analytics. So that means going from a backward looking, where we've done a lot of work on trying to understand how staffing affects, you know, store traffic, conversion, but can we come up with algorithms that decide on the optimal amount of staffing per store type, you know, a more normative stand, normative point of view. The other one is using new data sources. So these are especially big data, has a lot of potential in there. So where at the same time, I have to say, there's a lot of companies that are now jumping into big data and they're kind of skipping the step just to work with the data that they already have. And I would say, if you have a lot of data lying around, I would always start to, again, from the decision, what can I really do with the data I have? Because that typically is much quicker. And then at the same time, you, in parallel, you think about the new data source that you want to start collecting and have enough data in, let's say, a year from now to work on those. And yeah, that's going to be very interesting, right? There's going to be a lot of sensor data. So Internet of Things obviously is going to be quite huge, but these are also noisy data, unstructured data. There's a lot of text review data. So mining these new types of unstructured data, and that's where a lot of disciplines come together. So computer science, linguistics, and then the analytics in order to make sense of these unstructured data and do it in real time. So quicker, so kind of speed up the decision cycles. I think that's going to be a very interesting, that's going to be another interesting avenue for research. Finally, it's more, more powerful techniques. So machine learning is obviously one. We hear a lot about machine learning. And machine learning is in retail mostly used for forecasting. So you can imagine that Amazon, for instance, just announced that it has kind of designed a new neural network based